This is Where We Live. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. Last week, a team of American scientists won the Nobel Prize for their work uncovering the mechanisms behind the circadian rhythm, the internal rhythm that keeps us in sync with the cycles of day and night. Today, we'll dive into sleep cycles and more with Dr. Mare Krieger, professor at the Yale School of Medicine and author of the book, The Mystery of Sleep, Why a Good Night's Rest is Vital to a Better, Healthier Life. Dr. Krieger joins us from the studios of Yale University of New Haven, Connecticut. Dr. Krieger, welcome to the show.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
I understand that your experience in sleep medicine goes back several decades. What prompted you to write this latest book, The Mystery of Sleep?
Well, I wrote the book to arm patients with information because most doctors, unfortunately, do not explore sleep issues when a patient comes in. And many patients have really important sleep problems that they don't really bring to their doctor's attention. So the purpose of the book is really for people to explore their symptoms, explore what is normal, to see whether they in fact have a problem that needs to be treated, and then to develop the vocabulary, the words that they can use to actually explain their symptoms to their doctor.
Now, you're again involved in sleep medicine. Why is it that doctors at exams don't ask people about their sleeping?
Well, the real problem is medical schools. And most medical schools really only spend, most do not have any teaching about sleep at all. And the ones that do will usually only have 1 or 2 hours in all 4 years of medical school. So the problem is that medical schools and training programs really don't give trainees enough information about sleep. And it's not entirely surprising because sleep medicine is a fairly new field.
What do we know about sleep? Why do we need it?
Well, we don't know all the reasons why we need it. We know what happens if we don't get it. We know that our performance deteriorates, our thinking deteriorates, we can't concentrate, and we're also at risk of having all sorts of medical issues. And we now know that there are certain disorders, sleep diseases, if you will, that can really result in very terrible outcomes. So, and this is fairly new information.
Now, we're going to get into some of those disorders a little bit later, but when we talk about actually sleeping each night, what's happening when we sleep?
Well, there are all sorts of wonderful things happening. One of the things that we do is we dream, and everybody dreams 3 to 5 times a night. They may or may not remember the dreams. Some people remember none. Some people remember many of them. For some people, these dreams can be frightening, especially if they have something like post-traumatic stress disorder. The other thing that happens when we sleep is that we repair things. There are many hormonal changes that occur. Our tissues rest, they repair themselves, as an example. And the other thing that we know is that sleep is very, very important to lay down memories permanently. In other words, during the daytime when you learn something, it's there, it's there, it's not permanent. At night is when you lay down the memories so that you can remember them a day, a week, a month, a decade later.
Now, we're also talking about why, or before the show, we asked our listeners how much sleep they're getting, people on Twitter. We've heard from some that said maybe they're getting 4 hours of sleep on average. Some get 6 to 7. How much sleep do we need depending on our age?
Depending on our age, the average adult needs somewhere between 7 to 9, but there are examples of people outside of that range. For example, elite athletes, for example, people like LeBron James, they may actually sleep 12 hours out of 24. There are some people who claim to sleep only 3 or 4 hours and say that they do perfectly well. An example of that is President Trump. Whether or not all of their functions are as normal as they could be, we don't really know. But there are many people who look at sleep as a waste of time. Science now tells us that not only is sleep not a waste of time, it's absolutely critical to optimal health.
So what's happening when we don't sleep? How does that impact our bodies?
Well, there are many, many impacts that occur, and they occur in different organ systems. One of the, for example, the most common symptoms that people have when they don't sleep enough is that they're very sleepy. They can fall asleep at any time and doing anything. And for certain mission-critical jobs, for example, if you're a pilot or an air traffic controller, that can be a disaster. And there have been several disasters that have been documented where many people have died because a pilot fell asleep or was very, very sleepy. There have been train accidents. You'll remember there was one in New York State a couple of years ago where the locomotive engineer actually ended up having a sleep problem, and he had fallen asleep while he was driving the train. Our judgment becomes poor when we're sleep deprived. Our mood becomes extremely abnormal. Now, in terms of problems with sleep that have other kinds of medical implications, we know, for example, that diseases like sleep apnea, a condition where you stop breathing, can result in high blood pressure, heart disease, stroke, and those kinds of things can have a fatal outcome.
This is Where We Live. We're speaking to Dr. Meir Krieger today, professor at the Yale School of Medicine, author of this new book, The Mystery of Sleep. He's joining us today from the studios of Yale University in New Haven, Connecticut. Now, there's a stat here, Dr. Krieger. The National Sleep Foundation estimates 47 million American adults may be putting themselves at risk for injury and health and behavior problems because they're not getting enough sleep. But you also write that when you're deprived of sleep, sometimes you don't even know that you're impaired, that that's impacting your performance and what you're doing each and every day.
That's absolutely true. People who have been sleep deprived for long periods of time very often are unaware that they're actually very, very impaired. And that's really analogous, for example, with someone who's been drinking alcohol. They may feel that they're absolutely fine, that their performance is great. However, their performance has, in fact, degraded a lot. And if someone has been sleepy for weeks, months, or years, they may not even appreciate that falling asleep at a movie theater or falling asleep at a red light is even abnormal. And we see this in a sleep clinic all the time.
Let's talk about some of the common sleep problems. You mentioned sleep apnea. I think in the beginning of the show, I mentioned that 40% of Americans yearly say that they suffer from insomnia at some point during that year. Can we talk a little bit more about what you have learned through sleep medicine about these problems?
Well, I want to begin by saying this, that almost everything I've learned about sleep medicine, I have learned from my patients. And over the years, I'm guessing, my gosh, I've probably seen about 30, 40,000 patients. And they were all unique. When I started in the field, there was no field. And so the only way you could learn is from your patients. So one of the things that I've learned, when I first started, everybody in medicine thought that, you know, you go to sleep, you wake up, everything is great. And now we know that there are many dangerous things that can happen during sleep. And sleep apnea is the most common condition that we see in a sleep clinic. And 30, 40, 50 years ago, it wasn't even described in the medical literature. And so there's been a huge amount of research and education about the condition. It's one where people stop breathing. They stop breathing repetitively. And every time they stop breathing, it puts a strain on the heart, the blood oxygen level drops, and the brain is really temporarily deprived of oxygen. And the only way that the person can start breathing again is for their brain to wake up. So one of the things that we learned is people with that disorder can wake up hundreds of times a night. And so that's the most common condition that we see. And now almost everybody knows someone who either has sleep apnea or is being treated for sleep apnea. It's that common a condition.
We have a caller who has a question about sleep apnea. Tom, you're on the show.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I had been diagnosed with sleep apnea, and I tried using one of the CPAP machines, and I had terrible results with it. The mask wouldn't fit my face properly, so it would leak and wake me up, and, you know, I felt like I was waking up in a hurricane. And the second question I had regarding this solution to sleep apnea. Is there such a device that doesn't use constant pressure, that it only pressurizes when you're inhaling?
Thank you, Tom, for your questions. And quickly, Dr. Krieger, explain to our listeners exactly what Tom's talking about, the type of machine that people with apnea are advised to use.
Sure. So the problem in most patients with sleep apnea is their breathing passage collapses when they're sleeping. And the most commonly used treatment is called continuous positive airway pressure. And it's basically a mask that fits over the nose and or the mouth. And the mask is attached to a gadget that generates a little bit of pressure. And the pressure sort of opens up the breathing passage, kind of like blowing into a balloon. That treatment can be quite invasive, as you will, as Tom indicated, because it's hard to get used to wearing a mask when you're sleeping. And so one of the things that we've learned is that, number one, not everybody is best treated with a mask and one of these pressure devices. And we're really fine-tuning our treatment. And some patients, for example, might do better with a different kind of treatment, for example, a dental appliance that they might wear at night that brings their lower jaw up and forward, and that works really well in many patients as well. And Tom might be interested to learn that there are now machines that are automatic that automatically detect when the pressure needs to be increased or decreased, and that is something that he might want to discuss with his doctor, whoever's treating him. But I understand that yes, it is uncomfortable. Many patients put up with the comfort because they feel that much more alert during the daytime.
This is Where We Live. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. We're learning about sleep today. In studio with us is Dr. Mary Krieger, professor at the Yale School of Medicine and author of the book, The Mystery of Sleep, Why a Good Night's Rest is Vital to a Better, Healthier Life. He joins us today from the studios of Yale University in New Haven. We'll be back after a short break. This is Where We Live. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. Common sleep problems include snoring and sleep apnea. How do these and other disorders affect your health? We spoke about some of the disorders before the break, and it turns out common problems like insomnia and restless leg syndrome affect women more than men. Today we're exploring sleep with expert Dr. Mary Krieger, professor at the Yale School of Medicine and author of the new book, The Mystery of Sleep. We're getting a few listener tweets. Jess writes, I get about 5 to 6 hours a night. Chronic pain makes it harder to get more than 6 hours of sleep at a time. Another from Helder, I've been dealing with sleeping problems for years. Lately, I tend to wake up at 1 or 2 and can't fall back to sleep until 4 or 5. So, Dr. Krieger, if we could talk more about insomnia and why this is such a common problem.
Insomnia is an incredibly common problem. And as you mentioned earlier, about 40% of the adult population in America suffers from insomnia at least once a year, and about 15%, somewhere between 10 and 15% of the adult population has significant insomnia most of the time, 3 to 5 times every single week. And insomnia it can be very, very distressing. When someone is lying in bed and they're not falling asleep, people become frustrated, they become anxious about not falling asleep. They try to fall asleep harder and harder, and it doesn't work. And it also happens, as the person tweeted, people will wake up in the middle of the night and then have a great deal of difficulty falling asleep again. Now, there are many conditions that are associated with insomnia. For example, people with arthritis, and one of your listeners mentioned that they have a lot of pain. Any condition that causes pain can actually cause insomnia, and the conditions that are associated with insomnia need to be treated. As the most common example that we see in a clinic are people who are being who have been diagnosed with depression. About 50% of people with depression actually will have insomnia. They'll have trouble falling asleep or staying asleep. And one of the things that we know is that some of the medications that are being used to treat depression can actually make insomnia worse or actually cause restless leg syndrome that we'll probably get into in a couple of minutes.
So, Dr. Krieger, when you mention insomnia, are there any over-the-counter meds that people can take to help them?
There are over-the-counter meds, and they fall into two categories. And one of the categories are medications that include melatonin. And the other category of medications that are out there are medications that include what we call a sedating antihistamine. In other words, an antihistamine that actually has as a side effect sleepiness. Neither one of those treatments, unfortunately, is very, very effective. The antihistamine treatment frequently leaves people groggy, and the melatonin is not a very powerful medication to put one to sleep. It's much more effective to change someone's circadian clock, for example, in dealing with jet lag and conditions like that. So the over-the-counter medications, unfortunately, are not fabulous in the treatment of insomnia. But one of the things I want to mention is that pills, there are many sleeping pills, prescription sleeping pills on the market, is that sleeping pills are not the first thing that doctors should use to treat insomnia. It should really be the last thing that they use to treat the insomnia. The most commonly used treatment that we have in our clinic, for example, at Yale, is what's called cognitive behavioral therapy. We basically teach the person to fall asleep again. Falling asleep should be natural. You shouldn't have to work at it. It should be natural. And we have a practitioner who's extremely experienced in administering that type of treatment.
We want to take another call. Karen's calling from Brantford. Karen, you're on the show.
Thank you. Hi. Yeah, I just wanted to make people aware of a device, an oral appliance that I have found to be so far superior to a machine, which I couldn't tolerate, and that is a laser-printed mouth appliance that's perfectly shaped to your own teeth. And is so thin and lightweight and has saved my marriage.
Well, we're glad to hear that.
Yeah. So what you're describing is called the Narval appliance. And this is one of the oral appliances that we frequently actually prescribe for the treatment of sleep apnea. And that type of appliance in many patients is effective. And it brings a lower jaw up and forward, and it can be extremely effective. And for most patients, it's more comfortable than using a CPAP machine.
I wanted to talk. Oh, go ahead, Dr. Krieger.
Yeah, and so the message is that if one type of treatment isn't effective, the person shouldn't just give up. They should go back to their doctor or their sleep specialist, if they're seeing one, to explore other options.
Dr. Krieger, before we run out of time, I wanted to get into why you've dealt much in your book, The Mystery of Sleep, with why women suffer from more sleep problems than men. What have you discovered?
Well, one of the things about females, about women, is that they have more sleep problems their entire life, and there are many reasons for this. One of the reasons actually is related to their menstrual cycle. During the menstrual cycle, their reproductive hormones, estrogen, progesterone, FSH, they go up and they go down. And one of the things that we've learned is the reproductive hormones, these sex hormones, actually they also have an effect on the central nervous system. And women during the menstrual cycle can actually have problems with sleep, particularly before menstruation. then women become pregnant. And during pregnancy, sleep can really be horrible. And towards the end of pregnancy, women may have a significant heartburn interfering with their sleep, restless legs. They can have snoring. They just can't get comfortable. And the baby's kicking can, in fact, keep them awake as well. And then later on, women will become menopausal. And during menopause, there are these dramatic reductions in the sex hormones, and that has an effect on hot flashes. Hot flashes become very, very common. And women will frequently have hot flashes and feeling really warm and uncomfortable and sweating during sleep, and that'll interfere with things. And then later on, women have certain conditions that are just more common than the same conditions in men. For example, arthritis, and these are also associated with sleep issues. So women have a lot more sleep problems than men because of these reasons. And then the other reason, of course, is lifestyle. In that in many families, it is the woman who, you know, the mother, who's the last to go to bed at night and is the first one up in the morning. And so there's a tremendous amount of potential sleep deprivation in women compared to men.
We've just got a couple more minutes before the end of our before we get to break, Dr. Krieger, but something that Karen had mentioned when she called is that this certain device helped her save her marriage. And you talk about in your book about people who may not have sleep problems or disorders per se, but how they're impacting their partners, the secondhand sleep problems.
Yeah. So if one person has a sleep problem in a family, everybody in the family has a sleep problem. And for example, someone who's trying to sleep next to a snorer, on the average, will probably lose about an hour of sleep a night. If someone moves a lot during sleep, has restless leg syndrome, the movements are going to bother the person sleeping next to them, and they're going to have a lot of difficulty. And then there are the other, there's a condition that we see called REM sleep behavior disorder, where people react to what they are dreaming, and they can punch and they can harm their bed partner while they are sleeping. So there's no such thing in a family as a sleep disorder affecting only one person. It affects everybody.
And Dr. Krieger, we know many of us are sleep deprived. What do you think about napping?
Napping is terrific. and I see that, you know, you are giggling, and it is terrific, and it's highly recommended. And the ideal length of a nap is somewhere between 15 and 30 minutes. And for example, if someone is on a long drive and they find that they're having trouble, they're having trouble focusing, they're biting their lip in order to stay awake, they're opening the window, and in some cases they'll even put their head outside the window like you might have seen a dog do in order to stay awake. When you get that tired, it's red alert. You're now in a dangerous situation, and what you need to do is to pull over and actually take a nap. Now, one of the things that is recommended is that if you're going to do that, you should probably grab a cup of coffee immediately before the nap, so that by the time you wake up from your nap, the coffee will have reached a level where it's actually waking you up.
I was giggling because who has time to nap these days, Dr. Krieger?
Everybody has time to nap. It's just
a matter
of—
You
need to make time. You need to make sleep a priority.
This is Where We Live. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. Today with us is Dr. Mayor Krieger, who's professor at the Yale School of Medicine. He's author of the new book, The Mystery of Sleep, Why a Good Night's Rest is Vital to a Better, Healthier Life. We're running out of time, but Dr. Krieger, real quick about restless leg syndrome, any kind of therapy or medicine that can help with that disorder?
Well, yeah, let me first describe what we're talking about here. So people with restless leg syndrome have this urge to move, and usually the urge to move is in the legs. They can't get comfortable. They move a lot. And one of the things that we found in a sleep lab is that they twitch a lot during sleep, and they move a lot during sleep. It frequently comes on during pregnancy. But it does run in families. And one of the things that, one of the most important contributors to restless leg syndrome is a low amount of iron in the body. And this is something that people need to be aware of. And if someone has restless leg syndrome, their doctor should make sure that their iron levels are normal. And that often will solve the problem if the iron problem is solved.
That's Dr. Mayor Krieger. He's going to stay with us later in the hour. Coming up, we're going to learn how parents and children can get a better night's sleep. Some new parents co-sleep with their infants, despite caution from medical professionals that bed sharing can increase the risk of SIDS. We're going to find out how an American company is helping promote safe sleep practices in the U.S. and abroad. That's more after the break. Again, Dr. Mayor Krieger will stay with us. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. If you appreciate the conversations you hear on Where We Live, it's time to support this show. Here's how. This is Where We Live. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. Now, today we've been talking about sleep. Parents know how hard it is to get a good night's sleep with a new infant, and establishing good sleeping habits can be difficult in the toddler years, too. A recent report by NPR found that co-sleeping, when parents share a bed with their baby, is growing in popularity. This despite caution from pediatricians that co-sleeping can increase the risk of SIDS. So, how do medical professionals broach the topic of sleep while also encouraging practices that are safest? To tell us more, we're joined now by Dr. Keisha Gaither. She's a double board-certified physician in OBGYN and maternal fetal medicine. She also serves on the medical advisory board for the Baby Box Company. Dr. Gaither, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me. Good morning.
So just a little bit about co-sleeping, about what this practice is and why there are safety concerns.
Well, the AAP put out some guidelines a few months ago concerning safe sleep for infants, and basically it was to protect against SIDS. It's recommended that infants sleep in the parents' room. However, they don't specifically recommend sleeping with the parents for safety reasons. Parents might roll over their comforters and pillows and, you know, soft objects on the bed, which may, you know, preclude to the infant getting tangled up in it. And so, therefore, that's two of the reasons why it's really not considered safe.
We're getting a tweet from a listener, Heather. She writes, I have newborn twins, not much sleep here. So even though the guidelines on co-sleeping have been out for some time, Dr. Gaither, the reality is a lot of parents still co-sleep. So if that's the case, what are the safest ways to avoid, you know, accidental suffocation?
Well, certainly if you feel that you must co-sleep, I think the safest thing would probably be to remove all the bed covers. That way you don't have any risk of the infant getting entangled in anything while you're sleeping. I think that would probably be the safest route to go.
Now, I mentioned that you sit on the medical advisory board for the Baby Box Company. Tell us about this company and how they are promoting safe sleep, not just in the U.S., but abroad.
Well, the Baby Box is a wonderful company, and basically they are promoting a product that's been known for years in Finland, almost 80 years. Finland has the lowest incidence of baby or infant mortality, and it's pretty much due to several things. One is the construction of a baby box. Two, the information that is given to parents to assist with anything from high-risk pregnancy conditions to birth to care of the infant afterwards. And I think that Baby Box incorporates these things beautifully. They have a bed, which is in a box. It follows all of the safety guidelines from the CPSC as far as newborn sleeping. And in addition, what they do, which I think is wonderful, is to provide information to parents via their Baby Box University. And that information can be reached via www.babyboxuniversity.com. And it's a series of videos on everything from what I call the womb to the room. You know, there are segments on high-risk pregnancy. There are segments on birth. There are segments on the care of the infant after birth. So I think these things in conjunction with each other lend to a really great product.
And this is a stand-in for a family or a parent who may not have a bassinet or a crib.
That's true. That is true. Baby Box has promoted this product to a number of places nationally and internationally. Recently in New Jersey, which is a wonderful thing, and also in Ohio and in Alabama, and they continue on the move with it.
Well, Dr. Keisha Gaither, thank you so much for telling us a little bit about the Baby Box. Again, she's an OBGYN, a maternal fetal medicine physician, also serves on the medical advisory board for the Baby Box Company. We'll tweet out some links from At Where We Live. Dr. Gaither, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you so much for having me.
I wanted to turn back to our guest, Dr. Meir Krieger, again, professor at the Yale School of Medicine, author of that new book, The Mystery of Sleep. Dr. Krieger, you must hear from parents often about problems sleeping. Sleeping, especially when they have infants. What are some helpful tips to help parents get sleep and have a restless or have a restful night's sleep, rather?
Well, yeah. So babies, when they're born, are what scientists call polyphasic. And what that means is they'll sleep anytime, not necessarily at night. You know, they'll sleep in clusters 2 to 3, 4 hours, then be awake for a while, 3 to 4 hours, and they need to be fed. And it's not until 3, 4, 5, 6 months that they develop what we call a circadian rhythm. In other words, they do most of their sleeping at night. So the first few months can be very, very difficult simply because that the baby has not established a circadian rhythm or a normal body clock yet. The brain is developing. It's developing all the mechanisms that can actually do that. Now, one of the things that we know now, and your last guest kind of emphasized it, is that one of the things that makes parents sleep better is knowing that their children are safer. And 10, 20 years ago, people were very, very frightened about their newborns dying of sudden infant death syndrome. And one of the big breakthroughs that happened at that time really came from some studies, I think they were from New Zealand, that showed that babies that were sleeping on their back were much less likely to develop sudden infant death syndrome. That resulted in what was called the back to sleep movement. And the reasons why a baby sleeping on its front is at risk is that it hasn't developed its neck muscles. It hasn't developed the kind of strength that it needs, that if it starts to suffocate on something in the bed, that it can't really extricate itself. And so that has been very, very important. So parents have learned that babies need to sleep in an environment which is firm, with nothing in the bed that can potentially block breathing. And what they now encourage parents to do is that after a few weeks, the baby needs to learn how to strengthen its neck, and what they'll institute is something called tummy time, where the baby will be put on its tummy under observation, and during this period, it learns to strengthen its head, it learns to move its head, and so that's a very, very important thing. What can a mother do or a father do while the baby is having a lot of difficulty maintaining sleep at night? Well, they can take naps when the baby naps during the daytime. But one of the things is new mothers are going to be sleep deprived whether we like it or not, unfortunately.
Now, if you're a parent, we've all been there. You try everything to get your child to sleep. You may rock them to sleep. You hold them till they fall asleep, and then you might put on a noise machine. But how do you encourage, these are all just short-term techniques, but eventually the baby will wake up, or it might lend them to, you know, have trouble settling themselves to fall back asleep. So how do parents become to help their children be independent sleepers at some point?
Well, yeah, and at some point they need to recognize that the child has all the machinery to sleep. And the machinery to sleep is at a certain age, it's developed, and the parents should not interfere with the baby's ability to fall asleep by always interacting with the baby as it's trying to sleep. So if a baby, for example, is in a bed and it's crying, there's nothing, if the baby is fed and so forth, and is dry, there's not necessarily a reason to pick up the baby, because what may happen is that the baby may start to associate falling asleep with being held by a parent. And that can then be a very difficult association to break. And there are many treatments for that, but it's something that parents need to recognize, is that the baby needs to learn how to fall asleep again when it wakes up at night, because everybody wakes up at night, and we need to all learn to fall asleep again.
This is Where We Live. Dr. Merrick Krieger is with us, professor at the Yale School of Medicine, author of the new book, The Mystery of Sleep. We have another call coming in. Cindy's calling from Durham. Cindy, you're on the show.
Hi. I have trouble staying asleep, so every night I take a small dose of both Ambien and Ativan. So knowing that other strategies might be better, like meditation, if this works for me, how bad is that?
Well, you're taking two medications to help you sleep. And most people can actually be weaned from those medications by what's called cognitive behavioral therapy that I described before. Is there a long-term harm in using sleeping pills? You're using two medications that put you to sleep. It's better that you not be on them, because how long are you going to be on them? 1 month, 1 year, one decade, 3 decades. And so people can become very, very tolerant of the medications, and they can get to a point where they no longer work properly. And so what I suggest is, if someone is on several medications to try to fall asleep, that they might be better served to go to a sleep disorders center and to actually find a doctor or a practitioner that can help wean at least some of the medications.
Dr. Krieger, just a couple of minutes left. You said earlier that sleep medicine is still relatively new. A lot has been learned in the last 30, 40 years. What do you hope will be the emphasis in the next 10 to 20?
Well, I think in the next 10 to 20 years, people are going to start making sleep a priority, just like 20, 30 years ago, people decided that they weren't going to drink and drive. In other words, if you want to stay alert, if you want to function at your best, if you want to be as healthy as you can be, sleep is one of the things that you can actually do, and something that you can actually control. So I think it's going to become part of our fabric, just like exercise is now part of our fabric of healthy living. Eating healthy is part of it. And I think sleep is going to end up being a very important part of the fabric of health.
I have to ask, there's lots of apps out there to help you sleep, to meditate. What's your take on those, Dr. Krieger?
Well, we're very, very early in evaluating some of these apps. Some of the apps, there are apps that help people sleep. There's one that was developed at Stanford at the VA, and it helps people sleep. And that's one that may help. Some of them have been evaluated. A lot of the apps that monitor sleeping actually are not necessarily helpful, and people generally will use them for 1 or 2 months and then say, look, I already know that I'm only sleeping 4 or 5 hours a night. What do I need this app to tell me that I'm not sleeping enough? And a lot of people stop using those types of apps because they don't find them all that useful.
And I understand that you get 7 to 9 hours of sleep?
Yes, I do.
And how do you do that? How do you make sure that you're as rested as possible?
I make sleep a priority. You know, I mean, this is the thing, is that if I want to be wide awake and alert, I need to get my 7 to 9 hours. And as a doctor, I don't want to be taking patients with my eyes half closed.
Well, that's a good thing. Dr. Mary Krieger, professor at the Yale School of Medicine, author of the new book, The Mystery of Sleep, Why a Good Night's Rest is Vital to a Better, Healthier Life. He joined us today from the studios of Yale University in New Haven, Connecticut. Dr. Krieger, thank you so much for your time. We appreciate it.
Oh, it's a pleasure.
Today's show is produced by Lydia Brown. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. If you appreciate the conversations you hear on Where We Live, support this show. Here are two of my colleagues to tell you how.